All right. So this is the fifth fundamental teachings class, I believe, on suchness. So I've said this a number of times, but the teachings that we've been covering in this series are not philosophy or metaphysical speculation, even though sometimes they can get a little, can seem to get a little heady, and there's, we can talk about them, and it tends to go down the intellectual or philosophical easily. But that's not what they're about. It's not about the Buddha or Zen teachers saying, we got a theory about how the world is, and so this is our vision of how everything is, and we'll go toe to toe with the physicists about how things really are, right? That's not what it's about. It's about pointing out things for us to experience as human beings, which liberate us from suffering and get us out of our self-imposed limitations. So they have a purpose. And they are about not about understanding, learning, memorizing, even understanding new ideas or concepts, but rather challenging the ideas you already have, the views you already hold, and are generally either unaware of it or kind of unable to change that. So I figured I would just I'd tell a little story that leads up to suchness. How it's a Buddhist story of our troubles and our liberation. So as soon as you were born, maybe even before, you started developing an awareness of your separateness from other beings and things. An awareness of your basic feelings of like and dislike. Even an amoeba has that, right? Good, bad, comfortable. I want this, that's nourishing, whatever. So you wanted warmth, closeness, or milk. But sometimes these things were not delivered to you when you wanted them. Inevitably, there was a very vague and undeveloped sense of self with your desires and needs, versus whatever fulfilled those needs and sometimes not. So kind of that rude awakening to like, there's others, there's a universe, and it's not under my control. And over the years, your sense of yourself and the world grew more complex and differentiated by the day. You realized your perceptions were not necessarily shared by those around you. You had a unique appearance, position within a web of social relationships. You had certain abilities and talents, but lacked others. You learned to speak and write and think abstractly. You learned about sexual attraction, relationships, responsibilities, cultural expectations. You learned about not just the world immediately around you, but even in cultures across the world you may never see, things that have gone on in the past, chemical and physical realities you will never actually witness with your own senses. The list goes on and on. So through all of your experiences and your education, you created a mental map of reality. Almost nothing strikes wonder into your heart anymore. The second you see a small animal with wings and feathers, you label it bird and recall a whole bunch of information about such creatures. Bird isn't going to, create a hole and burrow into your house, right? Birds don't do that. You know what to expect of birds. You see your friend. And there immediately arises in your mind your sense of this person, colored by your history with them, how they tend to be, and your opinions about them. You know how you're supposed to interact with each person you meet throughout your day, depending on whether they are a family member, school teacher, waiter, taxi driver, random stranger. You navigate quickly and efficiently through your life with the aid of your mental map. Instead of wandering about with your mouth hanging open like a toddler encountering the world for the first time. So much of your day, whenever you aren't responding directly to what's happening in front of you, your mind is preoccupied, pondering beings and things and locations within your mental map, constructing narratives about what has happened in the past, analyzing what is currently unfolding, contemplating what might happen in the future. Very little fresh information gets in most of the time. And within the web of narratives that make up your mental landscape, you are the protagonist. Central to whatever dramas you perceive as unfolding in your life or in the greater world, it's about the fortunes of this protagonist. Naturally, you are profoundly concerned with this protagonist's survival, health, well-being, safety, experiences, relationships, worthiness, capacities. It seems obvious you should get to know this protagonist very well and work to ensure their safety and status in the world. Depending on what happens, your narratives can cause you a fair amount of stress and negative emotions, but to you, they seem synonymous with reality. Then you meet the Buddha. He tells you to start closely examining your experience, watching what is happening in your mind in real time. And you recognize your protagonist is not in charge the way you think they are. I mean, they can't even decide to sit and meditate without thinking. Not even that is under the control of the protagonist. And everything you identify as being evidence of your protagonist or being within the control of your protagonist or belonging to it proves to be much more ephemeral and insubstantial than you used to think. Your mind changes and your desires change. So you keep looking and begin to see the gap between your mental map and reality itself. Sometimes your mental map is proven to be inaccurate, or it's awkwardly different than the mental map of others. Through meditation practice, your ability to pay attention to whatever's going on around you increases. And occasionally, you notice something without the intervening filter of your mental map. And whatever it is you perceive that way looks surprising, worthy of wonder, bright, free from all your narratives of good or bad or interesting or irrelevant or anything. Occasionally, for a moment, even your sense of life as being centered around a protagonist drops away. This gets you pondering at a very deep level. What is real? More and more, you get a sense that your mental map is just a simplified representation of reality you have constructed based on your past experiences, not reality itself. What if your sense of being the protagonist in your life? What if all the narratives that give that protagonist contexts are similarly not what they seem? What if they are also a construction of your own mind? So this is how we investigate impermanence, insubstantiality, and dukkha or dissatisfactoriness in Zen. Anicca, anatta, and dukkha. So then, probing boldly, you keep asking this question, not in the abstract, but by examining your own direct, moment by moment, day by day experience, like a scientist. Through many small realizations, or perhaps through a few dramatic ones, you recognize how your sense of self, your narratives, and your mental map of reality are just projections of your own mind. This is unnerving, but it's incredibly freeing as well. You can stop worrying about your protagonist. Naturally, you would enjoy spending the rest of your life blessed by good fortune. But however things turn out, you are not a protagonist marked by a history that has already been written. You are not a protagonist proven inadequate by the decisions you are making, or doomed to discover whether in the end yours is a happy story or a miserable one. Narratives created by your own mind can be changed by your own mind. Reality, including you, is free from your thoughts about it. This is what is referred to as the truth of emptiness in Buddhism. Things are not what you think they are. You are not what you think you are. Aware that your life is unfolding perfectly fine with no protagonist at the center of it, you marvel at it. Your heart beats, your brain perceives things, your hands perform tasks. Memories arise in your mind, language comes out of your mouth, aspirations arise in your heart, experiences unfold as phenomena encounter your senses. If no protagonist is orchestrating or experiencing all of this, and yet all of this stuff is happening anyway, your life is largely the result of causes and conditions which cannot be said to come from you. Are you responsible for gravity, a breathable atmosphere, your DNA? Your body, mind, and heart have been shaped by infinitely many forces. In this very moment, when you perceive a sound, where is the boundary between you and the source of the vibration you perceive as sound? You recognize all things are self, and self is all things. No separation at all. This is what is referred to as the truth of interdependence in Buddhism. You are empty of inherent separate self nature, but very much exist as part of the fabric of all existence. Intrigued, liberated, you look around you and see things as it is. Reality with a capital R, free from your mental map. Every manifestation is complete, miraculous, and precious just as it is. You can perceive things as if encountering them for the first time, experiencing them without immediately incorporating them into your self-centered narrative. Over time, with practice, it becomes easier to perceive this way at any given moment. It gives you a perspective on life that brings unconditional joy and gratitude. This is what is referred to as the truth of suchness or thusness in Buddhism. Things as it is complete, undefiled, and precious. Just share a little piece with from Tigan Dan Leighton's book, Just This Is It, Dongshan and the Practice of Suchness. And it is, among other things, a explanation of our chant, the Precious Mirror Samadhi. So if you're interested in like decoding some of our regular chants, this can help. So he says, this is in the introduction. I should note and emphasize here as an important disclaimer that although I am using the term suchness, in reality, there is no such thing as suchness. Speaking about a Japanese term, immo, which will be discussed further, the scholar Thomas Kasulis makes an astute, important point. This term is often improperly construed substantially and metaphysically as suchness. But it is not a thing, it is a way things are experienced.
Oh.
Thoughts, comments, question? All clear now?
Yeah, I guess I obviously like it's like every so often you feel like you really I feel like I get it, right? Like okay, like I'm feeling like I, and then other times it's like I'm just off of my life and I am the protagonist and but it you know it brings out this these thoughts in me like if we could you know if we can embody this our experience with the way we interact with the rest of the world would change drastically in the way we're treating it. Things like, you know, degradation of our environment. If we didn't see ourselves as the thing, you know, as us, and then there's all this other stuff that I can use and take and chop down or whatever. But if we can find ways to embody it, or in the schools a lot they talk about like indigenous ways of knowing up here, and one of the things is how you know we've separated ourselves from the land, and you know, and this sort of thing. But like this sort of suchness, if we don't put ourselves in the. I'm sorry, can you hear my child singing in the background the whole time?
No,
Oh my God. He's just belting out show tunes in his room right now. It's a
we
little bit like okay, anyways. Sorry, he's a
are
musical kid. And so but it made me think of like what I've been, you know, I have these moments when I'm going out with my dog in the woods. And what you just reminded me of is you know, like I'm in there and like I'm breathing out. Carbon dioxide or whatever, and the tree is taking that in and it's processing it, it's letting out oxygen. And if we're doing this thing together, like where do we actually separate? Right. And I can have these moments and these things where it like really comes to me, like, right, like I and that tree are completely like not separate in that way. We're like, how, where does that differentiation actually happen if we're constantly trading these things back and forth? And I don't know, that's, I don't know where I'm going with this, but that's what it's been making me think of. And it's been, nice, I guess.
Yeah, that sense of interdependence, or you know, Thich Nhat Hanh calls it interbeing. Just, yeah, you know, always raises the great question of like, well, I mean, there's all these wonderful ideals. I mean, almost every major religion or spiritual path or whatever, like, if you really look at what it says. If you really followed what it said, you wouldn't be doing any of this terrible stuff, right? But it certainly seems to me to be an outgrowth of that, of where nothing, yeah, nothing is ultimately separate from us, whether we like it or not. Okay, I'm gonna say it. All right.
It was like the sweet Nazi.
Please,
They have to. They are part of the Sangha too. They have to hear you.
Can you guys hear me from this seat? No.
Yes.
Okay. It's very simple. It's just that I'll be sitting around, and then I think I'm accidentally in touch with what you're saying on my own, just sitting there. And I go, oh, this is really sci-fi. You know, that's what it feels like. It's like, well, science fiction is our attempt, maybe, to try to take in that part of it. That's what I'm wondering. I don't want to get philosophical here, but it's very strange to be a human.
Well, and I think that this is part of what draws people to travel, because then you're in an area where like you don't have a complete mental map for this, right? You don't know what people are going to act like, you don't know what that food tastes like, you don't know like where to go, you don't. So it's like you feel a lot alive, more alive, because you're paying attention, and you need to, and there's a kind of a sense of wonder about all of it. And then, you come back home, it's, I know what's going to happen today. And so this is like a, yeah, it's like this. I mean, one of my favorite things to do is like, you look at, I mean, on our society, we're just surrounded by so much crap. And we just generate so much stuff, and like just so you don't have to usually look very far before you can find something that you can just stare at, like, where the hell did that come from? And you kind of just, somebody conceived of this thing, somebody got the materials together, and somebody had a meeting about how we should make this thing, and like there's just everything you look at is just full of this, remarkable quality. Like this thing that ended up right in front of me. Go figure. Is it Dennis?
So you said something kind of interesting. Quite a few things that were interesting, but what jumped out at me was basically challenge your own reality. Kind of like the bumper sticker that says, "Don't believe everything you think," And I guess through that process gets us closer to emo suchness.
Yeah, it's to study Buddhism is to study the self. And if really that means just our own direct experience. I think I was my great talent for Zen is not my was not my deep insight. It was not, there it is. It was very intellectual. I was very tendency to strive and judge and all of that. But the great strength I had was I was very fascinated by myself. Very just, I mean, I didn't think I was more fascinating than anybody else, but I was just fascinated by being a human being and this stuff that happened in my mind and my body and let's see. Oh, Denny, did you, Denny and then Jinryu, or Denny, did you still want to say anything, or you still mute? Oh,
I
yeah, go
just
ahead.
excuse me.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I love what you said about how these things need to be experienced, and for that reason, they're very difficult to talk about most of the time. And I mean, I sometimes think I experience these things now and then, but I was thinking that the closest I could come to identifying something very simple that I wouldn't necessarily have to talk about, and you alluded to it, Domio, if not outright, made a statement about it, is just what it feels like to be awestruck, to just see something that just, and the expression takes your breath away. And it would be different for different people, but I love sky gazing. And I used to lie on my back and just spend a lot of time just when I was really anxious or something and look up at the sky. And it's like time is really focused in on just that one moment. You get, or I, all sense of my individual personality and it just sort of floats away, and everything expands, and I'm just part of this beautiful big space that's just constantly changing. Kids love to do that too. A lot of kids love to do that. So I just thought I'd share that for what it was worth.
Thank you.
Something that I used to think about when I was had only been here a year or two or three, maybe haven't thought about this in a very long time. And I did again today because I was reading on suchness, knowing that this was going to be the topic. And that is trying to imagine a meditation circle. It always seems to be a circle for me, but we don't sit in a circle and meditate necessarily. But I think of it as a circle. It could be a meditation hall, but whatever it is, there's meditation going on and I am not there. And that helps me to recognize that this moment of meditation doesn't have a whole lot to do with me. In fact, I could simply not be here and you guys would still do it. And I just find that helpful in trying to make myself right sized, if that makes any sense. And I thought of two things as the result of what others have said and what you have said. And one is, we were talking about our pets earlier and my cats and what their world must look like to them. It would have a lot of big feet, it would have a lot of chair legs. And wondrous things to look at that were way up here. So it's just another reminder to me of another view of reality. Everybody has their own view of reality. And finally, this dawned on me when Tyler was speaking of how animals look at us. I am reminded of a story that Keoghan tells in You're Still Here, and I'm not going to tell that story. But the story reminds me of that a fox is just a fox. That's all it can be. It can only be the best fox it can be. The same thing with the rabbit and the hound, and what they must think of us. Talk about invasive species. We are an invasive species. So I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Thank you. I think that everyone knows what suchness is at some level. And I think it is glimpsing or tasting it that, brings you to practice, that gives you a sense that there's something worth, something redeeming about this world. And these moments, it's like where there's a little, the mental map may not drop away completely, but it thins a little bit. And they just kind of, probably in a way, just happening momentarily throughout the day without us even necessarily registering it, and going, oh, wow, what an amazing moment that was. But when we do identify those moments, speaking of this, it's an experience, and how do you describe it? And that's one of the things that's so precious about Sangha, about fellow practitioners, is because we know what it is, even though I don't really, it can't be described, but we kind of describe a similar experience, and from our own experiences, know what that feels like, right? Because, I mean, one of the first times that I recognized this was like, I'm eating Oreoki and I'm looking down at my three bowls. And all I can basically say is it's like I just saw them for the first time. And that imprinted on me, that was a very like transformative moment, even though it's like went home and described that to my family. Like, I looked down and it's like I saw my bowls for the first time. But it's because you've had a sense of that, right? Of just like the tree, the light glimmering through the trees, even just somebody's annoying habit, maybe of sniffling or something, just suddenly, it's like, there it is. As it
Thank you very much for this Dharma talk. So I think the way it's making sense with me is like this: following the story is that we have this sense of separation that develops through the creation of this physical being, and because we have bought into this delusion that we are separate from everything, we then can be destructive or just believe that we're separate. And if we're able to work past that and realize that we aren't separate, is that then the experience of Nemo? Is that what the talk is pointing to, or?
There's different aspects to this, right? So when we realize we are not separate, that's like a prerequisite for perceiving reality. And there's many different things we can perceive about reality. So maybe in a given moment, you're going to perceive that interdependence, that sense of not being separate from anything, and that all of it is you are it. There is really no separation, right? So you might perceive that. You might perceive, I mean, one of the aspects of suchness is this sense of just inherent preciousness. Each manifestation in its own being is just a miracle. So there's that aspect of it, right? And it's not like they're mutually exclusive. I like this is reality with a capital R. It's one reality, but just the nature of our perceptions, we tend to can only perceive a certain aspect at a certain time. Does that make sense?
So it's not quite emo then. It's more like,
Well, emo, I would say, is synonymous with suchness.
okay. So
Emo is
it
just
is
another,
suchness then.
is the Japanese term for like the ineffable,
Okay.
is
Yeah,
as.
I'm like trying to wrap my mind around some of these Zen terminology. And I've listened
Yeah.
to your podcast and you talk
Yeah.
about emo, it with a capital I.
I mean, because the funny thing is that we're like, it's kind of silly in some ways to try to differentiate between these terms because they're like, words can't capture it and it's just one reality and all that. And yet, so on one extreme, which we want to avoid, is really suggesting like, oh no, suchness is this and emptiness is this, and like they're things, like they're separate things. But then the other extreme would just be like, Buddha nature is suchness, is emptiness, is awakening, like they're all the same thing. They're all the, which is like, well, then why did the ancients give us these different words, right? They're pointing toward different aspects of it which are important to awaken to. So like we're going to get to Buddha nature, which there's an, so it's another aspect of reality, which yeah, it grows out of interdependence and suchness and stuff like that. But so not to, we'll leave that for another day, but essentially then Buddha nature is like, so you perceive this suchness, this preciousness, everything in its own being is complete. Oh, me too. Me too, in a very, very like personal way. Like you in your own being, your body, your history, your karma, your everything.
Well, that's kind of my like what I was coming to in my mind was that if everyone could recognize that we aren't separate, that I mean, I guess other people are saying the same thing, right? It's like we wouldn't do what we do, at least the negative.
And that's where, and, yeah, and or you could put it in terms of we only do those things because we believe we're separate, and this and that is a to perceive that, to live that way is suffering. So it's like you could make this argument like, okay, well, in order to just survive ecologically on this planet, let's try to get everybody to see that we're not separate so then we can survive. When it's like the very fact that we're living this way is a sign that we're all suffering. So apart even from like the practical, we should just try to heal ourselves, right? Like to live as if we are separate is misery. So
So I like Buddhism.
and it's why, we can feel great compassion for those who do terrible things. Because inevitably, no matter what they perceive and how they might justify their actions, if they are acting in such a way as if they are separate, then they're not happy.
I'm thinking about what you and Isaac were talking about, and it reminded me of this phrase, which is a favorite of mine, where Roshi Kennett describes the 10th precept. So I don't know if this is related to what you were talking about or not. But she says, we are not individuals, but we are not the same. So I'm trying to bring that into the context of what we're talking about. It's one thing to momentarily perceive no boundaries. And to even perceive that for a number of moments. But at the end of the day, I will still be this female human being. And I can't be anything but that. I don't know if that's making any sense, but I'm trying to put those two things together.
Well, one of our classes is going to be on absolute and relative. This is another aspect of reality with the capital R, that it has these two aspects where, and I'm not saying this is exactly what you're getting at, but just making me think.
I don't know what I'm getting.
Because when we start to, you know, perceive suchness or whatever, and there's, so we have a glimmer of this kind of completeness and perfection. And then, you know, then we've still got our karma and we've still got the world and we've still got all this crap to deal with. And like, we forget about it. And so it can, the two aspects of reality can seem very far apart. And that our individuality can seem just kind of, I mean, depending on how you feel about your life, but it can seem kind of sad in a way. Sometimes people ask me, like, you know, it's just like, can we just like get this out of the way somehow so we can all be one? And it's like, well, that's not, without sentient beings, there are no Buddhas. If we were all just one undifferentiated sea of cells, who cares? I mean, the wouldn't those cells be like, we're all one. Like, the beauty of the oneness comes, is evident to us because we are separate. Like, we are individuals. That's the only thing we can be. And but when we awaken to the sense in which we are also one. So the classic example, which Okamura uses, right, is like, you know, there are separate fingers on this hand and it's all one hand. Like, so at different levels, like, so we are all individuals and yeah. We are all one.
Yeah.
It's very
sci-fi. Dude, it says it's very sci-fi.
Oh,
yeah.
Romeo.
Yeah.
Since I'm a lazy scholar, when it's time for the Dharma talk, I thought, okay, I've got my pen and my notebook, and thank you for starting with the story, ending on the comment on suchness. I thought, oh, we could all go home. I mean, that was so beautiful and complete. And then good that, I mean, I'm glad to hear people's comments and the discussion. And when I do kind of, I call it the circle of metta, where I think of entities that I feel I have the least in common with is as I live my life, or whatever group seems so far out there in our society. And then I think that concept of forgiveness isn't really even a bridge to cross. I mean, because if I can hold this story you started tonight's talk with, it's like it touches the tip of the iceberg of my understanding, and it just kind of melts. So So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, inevitably, which is why we go into the teaching of absolute and relative, inevitably, when start describing, you know, every being and thing and situation is luminous and precious just as it is, you know, we can go, wait a second, even that person, even this situation, like how can that be? Which of course then the answer is like it is and it isn't. In the what I call the dependent dimension, it is not, and you know, we should do what we can, do what we feel is right. But to describe the independent dimension when you contemplate something which is something or someone which you feel is completely unacceptable. This is why sometimes the absolute or the independent dimension is described as perfect. And to me, that word just has too much, just a little bit too much baggage. It's kind of like, because perfect makes me think like it has no flaws. Mm-hmm. It's a little too much. So I guess, I mean, precious and miraculous, I guess, for me, it seems like when I can momentarily regard this situation, this person, whatever, with no story, no expectations of how it should be. In that sense, I can look at, I mean, I can look at the climate crisis momentarily. I can look at it and just see it for an unfortunate tragedy in a way that isn't, it doesn't have my self-investment in it. That it is like, how else did we, who said this shouldn't happen? Who said this wasn't going to happen? You know, where is that story? Where is that expectation? That like, now in the dependent dimension, we can say, what a horrible tragedy. Let's do everything we possibly can to avert it. Because life is precious, all lives are precious, etc. So it's difficult to describe unless you have a sense of it, of how being able to just open up to the awareness of the independent dimension momentarily is like a huge, it's like an immense refuge. An immense catharsis of just, it's a ground on which to stand, because suchness is undefiled, it's unmarred, it is not dependent on anything turning out.
The world is not a safe place.
The world is not a safe place. No. But, I mean, you know, so in that absolute and relative, if we get stuck in either one, we go awry, you know? If we, which that's always like, I'm always a little wary because I always think like, Zen people and Buddhists and I don't know, white middle class people and whatever tend a little onto the complacent side, right? So I'm like, ooh, no, I don't really want you using the emptiness teachings to just be like, all things are just as they are. Like, so you can hide out there and deny the other side. And yet if we only dwell in the other side and we just a mad frenzy of trying to fix everything, we're just completely overwhelmed.
The world is a safe place.
The world is also there's also safety. There is also safety and compassion. So you see why emptiness sounds negative, and in some ways it is. Because we have to go through that gateway of things are not what you think they are. And things are not what you think they are.
What are
Look
they?
how they are. Look how amazing they are. Anything else? We have 3 minutes. All right. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Mahavira, Parama Paramahansa.
Thank you. Bye.
Great.
Bye.
Sweet dream.